And we're here in Portland, Oregon for our election road trip. And one of the things you notice about this city is that it feels kind of like a city on the East Coast. It is dense in its core. There are people walking. There's public transportation. And there is an aversion to sprawl, and that's by design. There's something here called an urban growth boundary, an invisible border around the city with housing and offices on the inside and farmland and fields on the outside. I met up with Professor Ethan Seltzer of Portland State University's Toulon School of Urban Studies and Planning at Pioneer Square in Portland. They call it Portland's living room. It's a bustling brick gathering place nestled between mid-sized historic buildings. He took us back to that moment that anti-sprawl idea was written into law.
Back in the 1970s, we had a Republican governor who was quite concerned about the impact of urban sprawl on the Willamette Valley. The Willamette Valley is an incredibly abundant place. The challenge here is not to get things to grow, it's to cut them back fast enough. And at that time, agriculture and forestry were mainstays of the Oregon economy, and urban sprawl was seen as a direct threat.
And so they created just a ring around the city, and not just the city, but other cities in Oregon as well.
Well, yes and no. What they arrived at was the notion that every city and every county should have a comprehensive land use plan, that we should be thinking out 20 and 30 years into the future, and that we should be making decisions about converting land from rural to urban very, very carefully. Because once that decision is made, you can't remake it.
And this had popular support?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's been challenged at the ballot box about four times, and all those efforts have been overturned by the voters. Most recently, though, it's kind of interesting. We had a ballot measure that was really a property rights measure and was a direct threat to the land use system. And after people saw what its impacts would be, voted to essentially reverse that decision.
Oregon's U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley remembers that battle. He was the Speaker of the House in Oregon at the time.
It was one of the major, my major goals as Speaker was to save our land use system, and we did get that before the voters, and the voters did affirm keeping our current system in place. And it is pretty remarkable when you go to this invisible boundary, and you're in housing, and next thing you know, you're in fields. And whoa, how did that happen?
Well, now we have come to the urban growth boundary, or at least part of it, and we're here with somebody who lives right next to it, Jim Moore, political scientist at Pacific University in Forest Grove. Jim, tell us where we are right now.
Sure. We're on the west side of Portland. We're right on Northwest West Union Road. To the north of Northwest West Union is agricultural land. It's going to be agricultural land for probably the next 50 years. So they have cut hay in one of the fields we're looking at. They will cut hay in the field next to it sometime in the next couple of days.
I should say, it is a beautiful vista across the road here. I almost feel like I'm in the English countryside, except there are more pine trees here. But it is completely undeveloped.
Yeah, we're looking at red-winged blackbirds in a marsh right now. We're looking at you know, a nice little forest land around a farm. And it goes up to the hill in the distance where the city of Portland boundary actually is. Yeah, it's really idyllic. Behind us is where I live, which is a suburb you would find anywhere in the country. Everything is some form of beige. You know, the school buses come through and people go behind their garages and close the doors.
So you're a fan of the urban growth boundary?
Yeah, I'm a fan of the urban growth boundary. People have criticized it because they say it drives up land prices and housing prices. But compared to other places around the country, there's not that much difference. And I also like the fact that this isn't going to be like California, where a suburb might appear 2 miles away out in this. And in effect, there will be this leapfrog effect going on. This is a nice green wall right here.
As Jim Moore just said, the main criticism is that by limiting the physical growth of Portland, policymakers are driving up housing prices and forcing a growing number of citizens to share an amount of space that isn't expanding fast enough. Ron Saxton is a lawyer who ran as a Republican for governor of Oregon a decade ago.
The idea of keep the growth one place and keep the farms another, I think, is a sensible idea and wonderful. The criticism is that the government's been too slow to change it as the population grows. So when you keep the boundary too tight, it drives housing prices up. And housing affordability is terrible here. And I think that there's a supply and demand. And so the urban growth boundary was never intended to be a fixed boundary that never moved. It was intended to be an elastic boundary that you mindfully expand as needed. And so I absolutely think the concept is a great concept. I'm not very happy with the implementation lately.
And Saxton isn't the only one tying the urban growth boundary to rising housing costs. An analysis by the conservative Cato Institute blames the boundary for the migration of tens of thousands of Portland families to nearby Vancouver, Washington, which is just across the Columbia River. Back in Portland's Pioneer Square, I asked urban studies professor Ethan Seltzer about that.
Yeah, I think it's a really simplistic view. There have been efforts to connect the urban growth boundary to rising housing prices since about 1981. And in every instance, the data has just simply not backed that up. Now, does the urban growth boundary have an impact on price? Of course, every land use regulation has some kind of impact on price. But I think what we've found through all the work that's been done here, both by people who are here and people from other places, is that, in fact, whatever the impact of the urban growth boundary is, it's minor compared to other impacts. Like, for example, the fact that right now we're a hotspot for migration of 25 to 34-year-olds with college degrees coming from all over the world to live in Portland. That has nothing to do with actually, it probably has a lot to do with the urban growth boundary. It makes it possible for this to be a really livable, desirable place. But nonetheless, it's not the urban growth boundary that's raising the price. It's the increased demand that's raising the price.
So you would say to somebody who's seeing their rent go up in Portland, don't look at the urban growth boundary. It's the new people coming in that are sending those prices up.
Well, actually, what I would say is we need to produce more housing. And I think the way we do that is by actually revisiting some real sacred cows, not the urban growth boundary, but single-family detached neighborhoods that get treated as if, you know, they ought to have some kind of special status and be held harmless from any change, you know, forevermore. The fact of the matter is that every neighborhood in the city has got to contribute to providing more housing. And I think that's our next threshold of challenge here, is to find ways to do that that both satisfy the needs of people who are here for this sense that they have control over what's happening, but at the same time yields much more housing for people who will be coming.
Does this mean that Portland is eventually going to look like Vancouver or Hong Kong with a lot of high-rise buildings in order to make sure that you're not expanding ever outward?
Yeah, that comes from the Blade Runner school of city planning, you know, that there's this dystopian future of density that no one in the United States has ever experienced or even can really imagine outside of Hollywood movie makers. No. In a word, no. It's not what's going to go on. But on the other hand, it might mean that you might find a couple of more housing units on the block you live on. And if we did that with every block in the city, we'd meet our housing needs without having to build 60-story towers.
If urban growth boundaries are such a good idea, why aren't other cities copying what Portland is doing?
Politically, it's really hard. Portland never did anything it did because its primary objective was to be a model for some other city. Portland did all the things it did because it wanted to be a better city than it was. And what you see around you is the evidence of what people, citizens, and government and businesses have gotten together to do to make Portland the best version of Portland that Portland can be.
Every 6 years, a council examines the ups and downs of the urban growth boundary and decides if it's time for it to be expanded. In its history, it's been expanded 6 times. But last year, the council decided not to move the boundary, despite the fact that over the past few years, Portland's population has grown faster than most U.S. metro areas. One more thing Professor Ethan Seltzer believes is directly tied to the existence of the urban growth boundary: Portland's local food scene. He says the fact that farms can exist so close to the center of the city makes it possible for people to eat local more frequently than in other places.
Because I think what the urban growth boundary does is it sends a signal to the market that it's not worth speculating on farmland as potential urban land. So unlike a lot of metropolitan areas where you have the city and then you have the farms kind of further out, and in between you have this kind of twilight zone where not much is going on and the land's not being managed and really no one's making any decisions kind of in anticipation of the change that will come, we don't have that here.
At least not right now. The council will make its next decision about expanding the urban growth boundary in 2018.